U.S. British imperial system that's been in place for 300 years, the capital structures that have been in place for 300 years that are now crashing down, and that when they lash out with 9/11, it's to save that. There's also the other related question of world military superiority, that is strategic domination in the military sphere that's at stake. When you see great powers grabbing oil, the first conclusion you have to draw is that you may be on the eve of a new world war. And I think that is the conclusion we have to draw today.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Webster Tarpley. Webster Tarpley is an author and lecturer based in Washington, D.C. He is author of Against Oligarchy, a collection of essays and speeches from 1970 to 1996, Surviving the Cataclysm, a study of the world financial crisis, and co-author of the critical study, George Bush, the Unauthorized Biography. His latest book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, debunks the official 9/11 story and exposes the fraud of the war on terror. Webster Tarpley, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Webster, I see you have a new book out entitled 9/11 Synthetic Terror. You have an entire chapter, I believe, on anthrax. Now, what do you address in that chapter? Do you talk about bio-warfare?
Sure.
What is that about?
The thing about the anthrax is that 9/11, the Pentagon and the World Trade Center towers are far away from rural America, the Midwest. There are large parts of the United States, many people who could say, well, as long as it's skyscrapers, there are no skyscrapers here. And, there are tens of millions of people who felt that they were not on the hook. But, of course, the one thing just about everybody does is go to a post office box or a mail slot at home or your mailbox and get out your daily mail. And as you remember, right, when you did this, you were always thinking, I wonder how many anthrax spores are in this envelope. And every unidentified piece of junk mail you opened up, you wondered if you were going to get white powder in it. So this was very effective Psy War. It was also used very consciously by the FBI to take investigators who were supposedly looking into 9/11 and to divert them to something completely different. It's very interesting that the FBI has never solved this crime. I think it's a key to the bankruptcy of their investigative procedures in general, if that were still needed. The one thing that's clear is that the anthrax spores that are involved here come from U.S. military labs. Now, there was a big attempt to point out the inevitable lone assassin in this case, and a man by the name of Hatfield, I guess, was widely targeted, not so much by name, but by profile. And the notion that he was some kind of a disgruntled loner who had been in Rhodesia, I guess, and probably a racist, and a lot of bad things that could be said about this guy. But as soon as we get the disgruntled loner, we immediately have to be suspicious, because this is the Oswald profile. This is what we've seen again and again and again. When the scope of the operation requires a network. And I would therefore say that what's behind the anthrax is a network of highly witting intelligence officials with biological warfare capabilities who simply make this happen. And they leave some false trails that lead to this man, Hatfield. And then they put on a kind of a show of going up. I live near this place, right? This is about 30 miles from where I live. They go up to Frederick, Maryland and start draining ponds in the summer of 2003, I guess it is, if not earlier, to try to find where he assembled these things underwater so that he wouldn't get the spores on him. So this is all crazy. In other words, this is all a kind of a dog and pony show, a spectacle that's put on. And we're left with the certitude that these spores come from a U.S. government lab. So that, I think, speaks volumes about the whole thing. And the guy that they've targeted is, as far as I can see, a scapegoat or a patsy or somehow somebody who could not have done it, didn't have the physical, technical ability to bring it about, in the same way that Oswald couldn't have done it, and in the same way that Atta, however monstrous his criminal intent, could not have done it, didn't have the ability.
Didn't they trace the anthrax right up to the gates of Fort Detrick?
Right, that's the one. Fort Detrick, Maryland, in Frederick. That's where it was. The other thing about it is that at a certain point in the investigation, the FBI authorizes the destruction of a sample, of a bank of anthrax samples held at a university in the South, I think in Louisiana, right in the middle of the whole thing, and then we're asked to believe that the poor FBI agents are overworked and overwhelmed and they don't really know enough about biological warfare, so they thought it was fine to destroy all the samples that would have made it even more specific in terms of exactly who had the spores in their hands. So this was fundamental as an element of the cover-up, and of course moles carry out the cover-up.
Yes, I believe that destruction took place right before the investigation traced it there. And wasn't it Ames strain?
Yes, I guess that's the one. I have the details in here. But I think the main political point is it comes from a U.S. government lab, and the FBI is actively on the scene destroying evidence. We have so many references to the FBI confiscating evidence, destroying evidence, intimidating witnesses, that the FBI becomes the black hole of 9/11 evidence. And you can judge the Kane-Hamilton Commission. Governor Kane said at one point that the FBI failed and failed and failed and failed and failed, but he failed to recommend the breakup of the FBI, which would have been the only conceivable response to a failure of this magnitude. He didn't do that. So that's his notion of intelligence reform.
Let's talk a little bit about economics. I know you have a whole chapter called The Catastrophe of Globalization. You've written quite a bit in this book about a looming global economic crisis. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. Here I have an interesting chart. I've tried to summarize the financial crises and panics with the capability of bringing on systemic breakdown. In other words, the collapse of the world banking system and capital flows since 1987, and I guess I have 21 of them. So all during the 1990s, as globalization was being carried out, you have two things going on. One is that all the energy of this system has to be devoted to overcoming these systemic crises, dollar crises, the Mexican bankruptcy, the Japanese banking crisis, the Southeast Asian crisis, Indonesia on the brink, and then perhaps most significant, September 1998, September 23rd, the long-term capital management crisis, which was a product of the Russian state bankruptcy. This brought the entire world banking system to the verge of breakdown. The clearinghouse interbank payment system in New York jammed up. They couldn't settle among the banks at the end of the day. Similar things were going on in London. And that's when Greenspan had to come in with a kind of a backdoor bailout. We have Argentina going to default, the J.P. Morgan Chase derivatives monster growing and then imploding. So this is an amazing catalog of instability. So we've got a completely unstable world monetary system. It just doesn't work, this privatized central banking and everything else. At the same time, the immiseration of the world is growing. My estimate would be 2 billion people under a dollar a day. You've got 40,000 people dying per day of starvation and diseases like diarrhea that can be cured, or malaria that can be treated at least or prevented with mosquito nets, very cheap things, the sorts of things that, you know, a couple of dollars would save your life from. 40,000 per day die of this. Really, the headline of every newspaper in the world ought to be 40,000 people died needlessly yesterday, and this is going on every day. And you can go on, right? 60% of the people in the world have not made a phone call ever in their lives. 1 billion people are unemployed. Hundreds of millions don't have housing or clean water and so forth. So globalization has simply been a disaster. Now, where we get to the 9/11 connection, I guess, is the dollar and the euro. Now, maybe you follow me into this. Monetary matters, monetary reform, world monetary system is a much neglected topic, but I think an important one. You got to remember, the dollar has the status of being a residual reserve currency. It was under Bretton Woods, and it still is. Posted price of oil and other raw materials is in dollars. The main IMF, World Bank, international lending institutions work in dollars. Most of world trade, or at least a lot of it, is still financed through dollar bills of exchange through the London euro dollar market. So the dollar is the thing, but it's losing out because of the inherent bankruptcy of the U.S. system. Here you have the dollar, supposed to be a world currency, and you're running a $500 or $600 or $750 billion budget deficit. It's actually $750 billion budget deficit right now if you count the Social Security money that's stolen or at least appropriated every year. And you've also got, probably more serious, a $750 billion per year trade deficit. That's with the outside world that you can't control. On your internal front, it's bad, but you can probably control it. But it's the international trade deficit that is really hurting. So the dollar is reaching the end of the line. There are right now $11 trillion in outstanding dollar obligations in this world. And there's nothing backing them up. There's nothing backing them up. As Mahathir Mohamad of Malaysia says repeatedly, and I quote him, the U.S. dollar has no visible means of support except the illusion that people have that it's worth something. Because there's no production backing it up. The number of industrial workers in the United States is now below 10 million for the first time since the 19th century. And this year, 2005, it's taking another dive because the textile industry is being wrapped up. It had been protected by some residual kinds of protectionist measures, import quotas. Those have now been lifted. So the whole U.S. textile industry is disappearing week by week as we go through 2005. This country has lost all connection to the production of anything in the real world. Financial services won't hack it. Public relations, Hollywood films, I'm sorry, these do not add up. You got to produce real things, real physical commodities, and the U.S. is pretty much out of that business. So now, what's going to happen? Saddam's crime was, of course, that he had dumped the dollar. He had switched from dollars to euros back in 2000, actually, and he'd been followed by North Korea. They did it, too, as a political gesture. Now, as of right now, and to bring it up to date, the information we have is that Iran is planning to dump the dollar in the coming months and to set up an oil commodity exchange denominated in euros. So that would mean that the dollar would no longer be usable to buy Iranian oil, only euros, and that bourse, that COMEX of oil that the Iranians would presumably set up, could be used by countries from all over the world. It would become an alternative to London and New York, denominated in euros. That's one. Second one is Russia. Russia has been negotiating with Germany and the European Union now for a couple of years to do something very simple. In the trade of oil, when Russia sells oil to the European Union, why does the European Union have to pay with dollars? They should pay with euros. Better for Russia. Euro is worth more. At least it's more stable. It doesn't dwindle in value the way the dollar has been doing. And you can multiply this, and I give quotes. I basically go through all the main oil producers. Venezuela is moving in a similar direction. Indonesia, similar kinds of debate going on. Very strong desires to get out of the dollar and into the euro. Maybe in some cases the yen, too. That's also possible. If this happens, this is a cataclysmic event. Let me just say that the British pound sterling used to be the world reserve currency from the time of Napoleon to the 1930s. And it had a kind of residual half-life like the dollar has today into the 1950s. And the end for the pound came when Saudi Arabia said to the British, no more pounds, we want dollars. That was then. Now it's going to be no more dollars, we want euros. And when that happens, there'll be a stampede of countries desiring to do so. If that goes through, every central bank in the world will have to take its reserve holdings, the money that it has, and quickly get out of the dollar and into the euro. That will probably reduce the value of the dollar to some fraction of what it is today. A quarter, 30 cents, 35 cents, I don't know, but some small fraction of what it is. And it will also mean that those $11 trillion in dollar holdings, stocks, bonds, equities, and all that, those will be devalued by 75% or 70% or whatever it is. And it will reveal that the world is much poorer than anybody ever thought, because all those dollar things were not worth anything anyway. It'll be a kind of a bankruptcy of the world. The other aspect is, though, that it will lead to colossal social dislocations in this country, because right now, as we mentioned before, the U.S. is importing $750 billion a year and paying for it with what? With green pieces of paper. Every other country in the world, more or less, has to earn foreign exchange to pay for imports. You want to import, you got to produce something that somebody wants to buy and export it. You got to get currency or gold or something and use that to buy your imports. The U.S. has been exempt. Now, that is not good for us. It's not desirable. That's one of the reasons we have sinking standard of living cut in half over 30 years, would be my finding. We're the buyer of last resort, but that's why everybody's unemployed. That's why you have a low-wage economy, because there's no imperative to produce something here that you could sell to buy your imports. Now, what happens when the world says, no, we don't want those green pieces of paper, pay us in euros, earn some euros, sell something in Europe, and then use those euros to pay us? Or get some gold and pay us with that, or something real, not dollars. Well, that will mean that instead of being able to import $2 billion a day of free goods, in effect, sending out the green pieces of paper, that flow will dry up to a significant degree. How much, you can't tell, but a lot. And at that point, you'll have a tremendous economic and social crisis. And ultimately, U.S. foreign policy, this policy of threats and aggression and blackmail that we see, is designed to convince anybody like Iran that if they dare to dump the dollar for the euro, they're going to be defined as a terrorist, and they're going to be on the hit list of the war on terror. So I think that's the present situation in a nutshell.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Webster Tarpley. Today's show, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I wanted to ask you about the dollar. Now, since so many other countries have so many dollars, it ties everything all together.
Right.
And it's like a big tent that's going to be pulled down. If the United States is pulled down, isn't it going to pull everybody else down with it? Now, even recently, just in the paper the other day, I was reading an article in the business section about South Korea, and they had made some statement to the effect that they were going to start increasing their holdings in euros or some other currency, and they had to back off of that because suddenly it created a drop in the value of the dollar, which created a drop in the value of their holdings because they're holding so many dollars. So they had to, like, back off of that, right?
I described the phenomenon that you've just mentioned in this book with a quote from this infamous Larry Summers, right, the woman-hater at Harvard. And that guy is a gangster and a thug, needless to say, but he's called that the financial balance of terror. It simply means that the U.S. says to China and Japan and many other countries, you already have tens of billions of dollars as reserves. If you dump the dollar, your reserves will become worthless and you'll lose all that money. So keep buying dollars. Except that that cannot work over the long term. That ultimately the Japanese and the Chinese and the others are saying, but every time we do this, we're adding to our risk. We're essentially becoming slaves of this worthless dollar if we continue to take it. At a certain point, rational calculation would be, cut your losses. Don't take more dollars. Try to get rid of the ones you have. Now, central banks all over the world have, at most of the time in the last 2 years, let's say, dollar went into a bear market in middle of 2003, as I list in here. Central banks have been lightening up on dollars as much as they can. It used to be that 90% or 80% of the world reserves were in dollars. Now we're back to 60-70%, and it's going down. It's going down gradually. But at a certain point, the rush to the exits will begin. And at that point, it becomes uncontrollable. Naturally, we know that the world is full of conspiracies, but there's also reality. And reality is you got to get out of this somehow. So The instance that you mentioned is precisely the model. It's a little rehearsal, maybe, or a little harbinger of what's on the agenda. Head of the South Korean Central Bank says we'd like to get out of the dollar as much as we can. Dollar tanks. New York stock market collapses. Plunge protection team runs in New York to try to keep the market up by buying stocks with Federal Reserve money, citizens' money. And they save the day for a day or two. But it shows that this system is cataclysmically unstable. And if that South Korean Central Bank had said, well, we're sticking to our guns and we're selling dollars, the bottom would fall out. Now, of course, the blackmail there is it's clear the U.S. has manufactured a crisis with North Korea precisely to blackmail South Korea, saying if you don't keep taking dollars, we'll feed you to Kim Jong-il. That's the kind of world we're now in. So it's extremely unstable. Everybody is trying to get out of the dollar, but it's a question of who's going to take the first plunge. And as soon as somebody does, there's going to be a mad rush to the exits in which some will get trampled. But what will also get trampled is the world economy as we've known it. Now, I would recommend something like a monetary reform. You now have three main currencies. You have the dollar, the euro, and the yen. You've got to get back to fixed parities among those, dictated by governments, not by markets, Bretton Woods. You've got to have some medium of settling, like gold. And then above all, you've got to have the commitment that a monetary system has to have the goal of world economic development, of raising living standards, of doing something for those 2 billion people who are below a dollar a day and the 40,000 that are dying every day. That's got to be the goal. So some kind of world economic development program with obviously jobs, housing, healthcare, schools, infrastructure, and so forth. And all of that has got to be produced somehow. And that, I think, ought to be the content of it. Now, if I may go on for a second, this peak oil question, right? A lot of agitation about peak oil. I find it's a dangerous reductionism to say that this is a peak oil crisis. There are severe problems with oil supply, mainly due, I think, to, at this moment, right, at the moment in time we're operating now, to 30 years of non-investment in oil. Iraq, for example, the U.S. has conquered Iraq. Iraq has not been surveyed for new oil in many, many decades, and there are similar problems around the world. That's no surprise, right? The steel industry has collapsed over the past 30 years, in the U.S. especially. Many other industries have collapsed more or less because of this lack of a world monetary system. So it's not surprising that oil should share that problem. The issue, though, is what's going on today. I assert that it's a crisis of imperialism. It's essentially the entire U.S.-British imperial system that's been in place for 300 years, the capital structures that have been in place for 300 years that are now crashing down, and that when they lash out with 9/11, it's to save that. There's also the other related question of world military superiority, that is strategic domination in the military sphere that's at stake. But oil can be procured at the present time. But here's the thing. We just described what happens when they start to dump the dollar abroad. There'll be tremendous shortages here. The regime at that point is going to say, they're not going to say the Wall Street gang has blown it again, Wall Street lays an egg, and that's why you're in such a terrible situation. They're going to blame an oil crisis, as they did in 1973 and 1979. And those were fake, fictitious, hooked-up oil crises. And that's what they'll do again. So they will come forward with to say, well, you know, we didn't do it. That's just peak oil. That's something that we can't control. And at that point, I think you have to decide, what's your slogan? What's your political approach to dealing with the United States after the crash of the dollar? Some people would say, well, it's to say, consume less energy and reduce the population. I would say that's not the right way to go. I would say your slogan ought to be fight the finance oligarchs, the Wall Street parasites who have brought this about with their mismanagement, and reform the system in that way by essentially lopping them off in a way that that would prevent them from ever doing this again. The question, therefore, is who is the enemy? Is the enemy the average person who wants to consume some energy to maintain a standard of living? Or is it the finance oligarch who has essentially ruined the world with economic globalization? So I think the definition of this question, whether you see it as a dollar crisis and crisis of imperialism, or whether you see it as a geologically determined oil crisis, this means everything in terms of the way you react to it. And maybe it doesn't seem like there's a lot of difference between the two. It's also the case that the oil business is subsumed by the dollar and imperialism question. Here's the other one. If you look at the beginning of World War II, you'll see that there's an oil grab going on. Hitler is going where? Hitler's attacking the Soviet Union. Where are the panzer divisions pointed? They're going to Baku. They're going to Stalingrad. What is Stalingrad? Stalingrad is a point on the Volga River. What's the Volga River? It's the oil aorta of the Soviet Union. It brings the oil from the Caspian Sea up into Russia to the fighting front. So he's trying to cut the Soviet oil aorta. Stalin has his own plan in 1941, which is to attack Ploiești, Romania, which is the German oil source. Japan is concerned mainly to take the Dutch East Indies. Their quarrel is really not with the U.S. or the British. It's the desire to get that oil in what is today Indonesia, but they feel they've got to eliminate the U.S. fleet and the British fleet on the way. Now, if you look at that, you'd say these powers are clearly trying to get oil for themselves and deny it to others. But would you say that World War II was started because of an oil shortage? No. It's the oil shortage. When you see great powers grabbing oil, the first conclusion you have to draw is that you may be on the eve of a new world war. And I think that is the conclusion we have to draw today, that the oil grab of the U.S. and the British is Iraq and then perhaps Iran later on, is not so much that there's a geological lack of oil, but that these two powers, in order to maintain themselves, feel that they have got to grab the oil resources. For example, if you grab the Middle East, who can you blackmail? Huh? Just Europe and Japan. And you can dictate policy to them. And I think that's what's going on. So it's aggressive imperialism that's your problem and not a geological problem. And again, that would dictate the way you respond to this.
With regard to 9/11, was there a slow build-up to that? I mean, we've just talked about a global economic crisis. Do you see that as the main impetus behind 9/11? Or did 9/11 come out of the blue? How did 9/11 come about historically, in your view?
Well, I think there are a number of currents that kind of lead into it. I mean, one of them is clearly is this notion of using military force to maintain the dollar as a currency and attempting to maintain this financial economic system. But then there's also the question of world strategic superiority, in other words, military domination. Wolfowitz, in 1992, wrote a paper in the Pentagon, which I quote at some length, in which he says, it's important now that the U.S. is the only superpower, he alleges, that no rival or challenger ever be allowed to emerge. Now, this would indicate preemptive action anytime a regional power like China or the European Union might attempt to raise itself up to the level of a world power. And he says in there in particular, we've got to make sure that no combination ever emerges, but Russia always gets top attention because they are the only ones who can blow us up. Later on in the decade, Samuel Huntington comes with his Clash of Civilizations thesis, article in Foreign Affairs, then a book. And there he says, who challenges Anglo-American supremacy in the world today? He says there are two challenger civilizations. One is the Arab and Islamic world, the challenge being rapid population growth. Then there's China. The challenge there is rapid economic growth, 10, 12, 15% a year. And I guess he's got his eye on Russia, too, ultimately in the back. So it seems to me that the targets are Arab and Islamic world, China, and Russia. This is where the neocons will take you if you go with them. Now, let's see how it looks on the ground. Clinton, they don't like, because in my opinion, he's understood the lesson of Vietnam, and he realizes that military action is either futile or self-destructive. So he's always, whatever his corruption and his failure as a president, he's always got this idea that he wants to avoid military action. However, it's sometimes forced on him. In 1999, and I think we mentioned this, the Principals Committee, meaning Gore, Albright, Cohen, Shelton, Richard Clark, some others, top bureaucrats, decide that they want to bomb Serbia. Russian Prime Minister Primakov is flying across the Atlantic to try to mediate a peaceful solution, which Russia could have done, except for the fact that Gore, in a kind of, you know, usurping Clinton's real power, gives the order to begin bombing Serbia with the support of Tony Blair. Now, bombing Serbia is like bombing Russia. World War I began because Russia was determined to protect Serbia against Austria and Germany. And in the course of this, you get the bombing going on for a couple of months. The bridges over the Danube are destroyed. Militarily, it doesn't work. The Serbian army is intact. And Tony Blair begins agitating for a ground invasion, a land war against Serbia. We have to now start counting. There are three times that the World War III question emerges during these years. The first one is when Boris Yeltsin, president of Russia, rouses himself to say, if NATO launches the land attack on Serbia, they will get a general European war and most likely World War III documented. Clinton, much to his credit, refuses to have the land invasion. So the bombing goes on, and ultimately Russia is able to secure a peaceful solution. Got to remember that somebody like Richard Holbrook is way up front in the bombing, somebody who Kerry probably would have made Secretary of State. At the end of this war, the Russians say, we want a zone of Serbia for us to occupy. NATO says no. U.S. says, no, you're not going to get it. So the Russians, they have some forces in Bosnia. They get some tanks, and they drive them to the Pristina airport in northern Kosovo province, and they seize the airport. And at this point, General Wesley Clark, Michael Moore's favorite candidate for president, I must add, and many other people in the Democratic Party seem to think that he was a good idea for president, Wesley Clark goes nuts. And he orders Lieutenant General Sir Michael Jackson of the British Army to go and kick the Russians off the airfield. The classic answer is, from Michael Jackson, Sir Michael Jackson, I'm not starting World War III for you. Second mention of World War III. Ultimately, the crisis gets down because the Russians don't have any food. So that's calmed down. In the summer of 2000, August 2000, the most modern nuclear submarine of the Russian Navy, the Kursk, is destroyed in the Barents Sea. It's in August. The Russians come out and say, this was a deliberate destruction of the submarine by a NATO submarine, most likely British. They don't know how it happened, but that's who they accuse of doing it. The Western media concentrates on the alleged ineptitude of the Russians, that they can't save the people, that they don't have a diving bell, and all the rest of this. But Pravda says World War III almost started on Saturday. That's the third mention of World War III in some sort of authoritative or semi-authoritative way during this period. So what do you have? You imagine the invisible government, these war-mongering types, military, CIA, special forces. They see that China is developing at 12% or 15% a year. The Arabs are not dominated necessarily. Some are, some aren't. And Russia is also beginning to rearm in some ways. They're building the Topol missile, the Sunburn missile, other kinds of military technology. What you begin to see is this restless desire for decisive military action percolating up from the invisible government through the neocons who are their spokesmen and participants. And then you get 9/11. So you can see that it starts going. Just a couple of things. The United States did not become hated in the world as a result of the Iraq War. The United States became universally hated as a result of the bombing of Serbia. That Russia went wild, and when the U.S. bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, China also participated in this. So this is the beginning of a lot of that hatred. So the American media never put that picture together. I've tried to do it. So we see that 9/11 is a result of a kind of an escalation. And the superpower tensions connected to 9/11, it seems to me, are closely related to the process that builds up. And that's also what this Namicon source says.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Webster Tarpley. Today's show, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I thought that was very interesting because I remember all that stuff about Serbia. That was just so unbelievable. And the bombing of the Chinese embassy and all of that.
This was a big deal. I mean, this killed 10 times more people than 9/11. And it's all based on a fraud. In other words, the genocide against the Albanians or Kosovars never occurred. It never occurred. This was simply a big lie campaign of the Western media to try to whip up some support for going and bombing Serbia. They bombed the bridges on the Danube and cut the ship traffic on the most important waterway in Eastern and Central Europe. And it took years before they got them going again, the bridges and the barges.
Well, now, also, didn't they drop depleted uranium on these people? Is NATO still...
It goes without saying. This is what they did.
NATO's occupying the whole place as we speak, aren't they?
The outcome is that there's a NATO peacekeeping force. This is also important because you can see also how it reaches up into the present day. In 1999, NATO bombed Serbia. It's the first time NATO ever went to war as an alliance. And it had to do with Madeleine Albright made this possible. In the year 2000, they're able to kidnap Milosevic illegally in flagrant violation of Serbian law and drag him to this kangaroo court in The Hague. Now, obviously, this person, he is a villain, and I tried to organize against him as much as I could when he was actually carrying out genocide campaigns in Croatia and in Bosnia. So I have no love for Milosevic, but there's the kind of illegal actions that were taken, I think, are overwhelmingly a bad idea. And then in 2001, you get the classic CIA people power revolution in Belgrade. And that worked so well that the experts, the sort of cadre of case officers who carried out the people power revolution in Belgrade have now gone on to Georgia, to the Ukraine, to Beirut, and so forth. And how do they do this? It's a media spectacle. What you do is you go into the capital, say Belgrade, you put up some tents, you get large amounts of narcotics, you allow orgies to take place in the tents, you get a lot of booze, and you get some consumer goods. The money comes from the National Endowment for Democracy, Project Democracy, the thing that Oliver North worked for. Interestingly, Chairman Hamilton of the Kane-Hamilton Commission, who covered up 9/11, well, he's also on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy. So this is not democratic. These are destabilizations. The recipe is, again, the CIA People Power Revolution. I think Newsweek a short time ago had a cover. You know, the cover was People Power Comes to Beirut. So you've got to have a catchy slogan. The same people who run the mass manipulation in the American elections, this group along Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C., are sent in order to somehow play on the ignorance and prejudice of these people and get some kind of a desired response. But the whole thing is done as a complete fraudulent spectacle on television. And this is now what they're doing. So this is essentially a way to overthrow these governments. It's interesting to see that in Lebanon, even though there was this Cedar Revolution spectacle going on in the public square, when Hezbollah decided to have a demonstration, their demonstration absolutely dwarfed anything that the People Power crowd was able to put up. So I think it's fraudulent, and it's to put it mildly, you send in the NED with $20 or $30 million, you're interfering in the internal affairs of sovereign states, and that's not a good idea. And experience shows that it leads to complications and perhaps the war.
You also examine something called the 9/11 myth, collective schizophrenia. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the questions involved here is, why do people believe this? What's the basis for the mass acceptance of the myth? In the first chapter, I go into the genesis of the myth. The genesis of the myth is in a few words that Richard Clark and George Tenet put out the line, it's Al-Qaeda, it's bin Laden. Bush repeated it, and then the rest of the people in the Bush regime. But the problem then is that many Americans don't believe Bush or didn't believe Bush on Iraq, certainly don't now, but they continue to believe him on 9/11. What can explain the tenacity of the myth, given the fact that the myth is absurd and there's a large amount of stuff in the public domain that would tend to show you that the myth is false, that it's hooked up? Part of this then has to do with the negative changes that have occurred in intellectual life in this country and in the kind of mentality of average people. I went and found, for example, Dr. Justin Frank, as far as Bush is concerned, right? Bush, he's got Bush on the couch. His conclusion is that Bush is a paranoid schizophrenic. And I think this is important because Bush, even though I try to argue that Bush is not the planner or indeed not really important in the carrying out of 9/11, at least up until he starts making speeches, Bush is the salesman of the 9/11 myth. And what you have to see is Bush as a schizophrenic personality radiating schizophrenia and autism out into the world. Now, perhaps a word on what these definitions mean. Schizophrenia, if you ask the average person, they might say, well, it's a split personality, which is fine as far as it goes, but and I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have tried to read up on these things. The notion is, developed by Silvano Ariety, the main authority on schizophrenia, is that it's the dissociation of the mental faculties, so they can't work together. That would be the split, right? The perception and cognition don't work together. Feeling goes in another direction, and it's all dissociated. But then there's another dissociation, which is that the schizophrenic personality has a very weak relation to reality. Now, that's Bush. Weak relation to reality. Dream world, ideological construct world, things of this sort. So he's a perfect salesman. And if you see, for example, an epidemic of autism in this country, it seems to me that there's something to be said for the idea that Bush and his schizophrenia is a factor in this. But now let's look at the people. There's a French psychoanalyst by the name of Joseph Gabelle, who in the mid of the 1970s, more or less, wrote a book on, he calls it reification. Reification or political alienation. And what he does is go to Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, communist Russia, and try to show how regime propaganda depends on what he describes as a schizophrenic world outlook. And he refines that to call it the police concept of history or the police theory of history. I would call it the CIA theory of history, or maybe the intelligence community theory of history. And what does this involve? It means, first of all, that history is not real. There are no real processes going on in history. So what about things that happen? Things that happen are either miraculous, wonderful events, or they're catastrophes. The world is then, and this is still the propaganda world of the Nazis and the Soviet communists, the world is divided between a privileged system, the U.S., in which everything is by definition perfect. Then there's the non-privileged system, today the Arab and Islamic world, where things are necessarily all bad. And the problem arises then, the critical moment arises when a catastrophe occurs inside the privileged system. And the response to that catastrophe is, since the privileged system is by definition perfect, the only way such a thing could happen is by the evil, aggressive activities of the outside group that you're targeting. And that is pretty much 9/11. Outside, outside, outside. In other words, the causes have to be looked for outside. I was interested to find that Gerhard Wisniewski, in his book on 9/11 in German, wrote that every aspect of the 9/11 myth screams outside, outside, outside. So Gabel wrote this 30 years ago. And what you find is an uncanny resemblance to his study of Soviet and Nazi propaganda as the expression of political alienation and of schizophrenia and autism in mass psychology, and the way that this 9/11 myth has been put together. Certainly the question of fear. It sounds needless to repeat it maybe, but the goal of terrorism is terror. In other words, fear. And one of the things that fear is relied upon to do is to somehow paralyze reason or, you know, rationality, cognition, and things like this, so that you believe things, you put into a kind of infantile state where you're willing to believe things that otherwise you would not believe. And you have to also remember, I guess as people can, that this was a tremendous shock. It was a mental trauma from which it was hard to recover for quite a number of months or weeks. And I hope now that the years have gone by, people are able to come out of this, to snap out of it. I certainly hope so. And that's one of the goals of the 9/11 Truth Movement, which I think is growing. The issue is more relevant than ever. The issue won't go away, 9/11, won't go away as long as we're living under this invisible government regime that fixes elections, starts revolutions in foreign countries, and above all prepares new wars.
One other thing. You have a section here called Islamic Fundamentalism Fostered by U.S. Foreign Policy.
Well, what I try to show here is that if you look at the history of the Arab states and the Islamic states, but in particular the Arab states, the ones that were part of the Turkish or Ottoman Empire, those were places that were in a kind of suspended political and economic development, I'm afraid, under the Ottoman Empire. In some cases, it was Napoleon's invasion of Egypt that got things going in some of these places in terms of ferment or modernization. But by the time of the 20th century, these places had begun to produce nationalists who were reformers, who were modernizers. And it's useful to remember a figure like Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in Turkey. I think he's pretty much the model for them, at least in the 20th century, though you can find similar things in Egypt going back even further. Atatürk is somebody who comes in with a modernization program. He lifts the Islamic law, the Sharia. He outlaws the veil, the harem, the fez, demands the Roman alphabet, comes in with five-year plans of economic development. It's interesting that Turkey is the only loser in World War I that does not go fascist in the 1920s or 30s. Most of the other, practically all of the other losers did go fascist, but Turkey did not. So this is, I think, a person of very significant historical significance. You can look at some of these other countries. Think of Nasser in Egypt, nationalizing the Suez Canal, wanting to use the money for the Aswan High Dam, for the economic and agricultural development of Egypt, industrialization, Arab socialism, pan-Arabism. You have to say these are mixed figures. There's a lot of demagogy. There's a lot of rhetorical excess. How did the West treat somebody like Atatürk or somebody like Nasser? Did they welcome the presence of a modernizing secular nationalist who was not based on Islam in any sense, not against it necessarily, or not against it, not determined to wipe it out? But what did the West do? These figures were opposed. The West did everything to destroy them, to humiliate them, to attack them, to isolate them, to remove them from the picture. And what I do in that chapter is I go through Iraq. Who was a positive figure in the history of Iraq? You don't like Saddam Hussein? That's fine. Who was positive? General Qassem in the 1950s. It was somebody who brought in a very interesting Republican constitution, tried to get economic development going. What happened to him? Foreign support for a coup. He's murdered. Saddam Hussein is one of his opponents. That's sort of the pedigree of Saddam Hussein. You look at Ali Bhutto in Pakistan. He wants to develop Pakistan, including with nuclear energy. What happens to him? Kissinger arranges for Zia-ul-Haq to come in and have a coup, and Ali Bhutto is actually hanged. You go through the rest of these countries. I try to do Afghanistan. I try to do as many as I can to show that the Western powers did everything they could to destroy real nationalists who were modernizers and secularists, and that, in a sense, they've also done everything possible to bring forward what I would have to consider to be relatively benighted or backward versions of the prevalent religion in these countries. In other words, people who were hostile to technology and science, who wanted women in a degraded position, who didn't like education, who were social reactionaries in just about every way, and also who were incapable of making alliances with Europe or other powers in the world that might have helped these countries to get somewhere. So what you have is self-isolating figures, in a way, that are promoted. Maybe the case of the Shah of Iran is also relevant. Here the positive figure was Mossadegh, right, in the early 1950s. So here's a secular reformer, secular nationalist, and of course what does he do? He's got to nationalize the oil companies, and at that point the British and the U.S., Kermit Roosevelt, do everything they can to destroy him. Then you get the Shah. The Shah, of course, in many ways is a monster, and he's incapable of developing a political alternative, but he does have a very ambitious economic development program, and he's pushing this through, and at a certain point, Zbigniew Brzezinski decides that Islamic fundamentalism is the bulwark against the Soviets in the Middle East and the Gulf, and according to my findings, Brzezinski essentially masterminds the overthrow of the Shah, and then demands that Khomeini be brought in as the leader of Iran. Now, the world has turned over a couple of times since then, but that's the origin of the current regime. I'm not trying to use that to argue for an attack on Iran, anything but. But that's ultimately how things got to be the way they are, this process of constant meddling. Brzezinski is maybe the clearest case. He says, Islamic fundamentalism is the bulwark against the Soviets. We will support it. So there I think you have it in a nutshell. It's that the current situation in these countries is the product of having deliberately and systematically destroyed the many positive alternatives that were there on the way. And I'm not despairing. I've been to, for example, Sudan, well, once, and talked to Hassan Turabi, who is considered, I suppose, to be one of the most hardline or most, let's say, most consistent of the Islamic fundamentalists. And I found that these people are reasonable enough if you could offer them forms of cooperation that they could recognize. It seems to me that cooperation could be had. But the whole policy of the British, the U.S., and, of course, the Israelis is to go against that and to harden things into these useless, absurd, conflictual relationships which don't get anybody anywhere. But if you don't like the present situation, you have to blame not the Arabs or the Muslims, but all these decades of imperialist meddling in their countries.
Webster Tarpley, thank you.
Thank you so much.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with historian and journalist Webster Tarpley about his new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, which debunks the official 9/11 story and exposes the fraud of the war on terror. His study of international terrorism began in Italy in the 1970s when he covered the terror wave gripping that country, including the kidnapping and murder of Prime Minister Aldo Moro. In 1992, he co-authored George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, a comprehensive and critical account of the former president and his family network. Posted for free on the internet at www.tarpley.net, this study has become an underground classic. He is also author of Against Oligarchy and Surviving the Cataclysm, a study of the world financial crisis. Webster Tarpley can be reached by email at tarpley@tarpley.net. That's tarpley@tarpley.net. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yaro Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of shows, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
Trying to steal your life, you know what I'm saying? Look what this act is doing for peace. Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin, you know what I'm saying? Now the question is,
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. The fifth annual Conspiracy Conference is going to take place May 28th and 29th at the Westin Hotel in Santa Clara, California. Speakers include Dick Gregory, Daniel Sheehan, Nick Begich, Daniel Hopsicker, Yuri Dubenko, and many others. Visit www.conspiracycon.com. That's www.conspiracycon.com or call 209-832-0999. I'll be tabling there, as will the San Francisco 9/11 Truth Alliance. I've never been to one of these conferences before, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Also, there's a rally Sunday, May 1st, from noon to 3 p.m., Reclaim May Day at Harry Bridges Plaza. Prominent speakers, labor and community activists, mobilization for a fight back against attack on working people and our liberties, sponsored by the Million Worker March. People's Radio report back from New York City, Pacifica National Board and KPFA. That's Thursday, May 5th, 7 p.m., Humanist Hall. That's on 27th Street between Broadway and Telegraph, www.peoplesradio.net. Also, don't miss the California tour of attorney Lynn Stewart, beginning Friday, April 22nd through Wednesday, April 27th. A couple of those dates, Saturday, April 23rd at 2 p.m., she'll be speaking at the First United Methodist Church, 9 Ross Valley Drive at 4th Street in San Rafael. Then on Sunday, April 24th at 2 p.m., she's the featured speaker at Mission High School at 18th and Dolores. There's a mass rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal and a concert by Michael Franti. You can look for more of the dates and her speaking engagements at www.lynnstewart.org.
But every time we do this, we're adding to our.
Youth Speaks presents the 8th annual Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam Festival coming to San Francisco April 20th through 24th. This unique event features over 300 teenage poets from around the country and beyond, along with nationally recognized Deaf Poetry Jam veterans like Saul Williams, Suher Hamad, Aya De Leon, Ishley Park, Bo Sia, and many more. They'll be joined by special musical performances from Dead Prez and Omaya, hip-hop theater from Denny Hawk, and others in 5 days of events leading up to the National Youth Poetry Slam. For more information and a complete schedule of events, go to www.bravenewvoices.org.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is just about 3 p.m. Stay tuned next for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 20, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Congress considers ways to increase penalties for gang activities while protecting the gun industry. Critics say two teenage girls being held in immigration detention are victims of racial profiling. And protesters in Ecuador face severe repression. We'll hear from Quito.